You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Albaugh Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Albaugh.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Todd Albaugh here at the world headquarters of Civic Media in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, along with our producer and engineer Aaron Zommers and Parker Olson. Glad to have you along here on a very busy Monday, June 23rd, 2025. I have breaking news to start the show. Later on, we'll have State Senator Kelda Royce talking about the Joint Finance Committee and breaking news from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in regards to cuts there. And also in hour number two, Matt DeFore, the State Bureau Chief of Wisconsin Watch, will be in talking about AI and newsmaking. But first, we begin with the breaking news of the day here in downtown Madison, but around the world, according to CBS News and others. A couple of hours ago, Iran said today that it has launched attacks on the U.S. Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar 2 days after the U.S. struck three nuclear sites in Iran. Explosions were heard in Qatar as witnesses said they saw what appeared to be missiles over the country, according to multiple news agencies. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it targeted the U.S. air base at Al Udeid in Qatar with a, quote, devastating and powerful missile, unquote. Iranian state media earlier today announced an operation launching missiles attacks against U.S. bases named, quote, Annunciation of Victory, unquote. The U.S. defense official confirmed that the base was attacked by short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles originating from Iran today. At this time, U.S. officials say there are no reports of U.S. casualties. They said officials are monitoring the situation closely and will provide more information as it becomes available. Joining us to discuss these latest developments today and also over the weekend, we appreciate him being with us. He was with us on this breaking news over the weekend on Saturday. We so appreciate it. Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, joins us now live via StreamYard. Professor, once again, thank you so much for taking your time.
Good to be with you again.
It's a busy day, to say the least. So you joined us over the weekend at these initial U.S. strikes against Iran. What do you make today? Because I think last time we talked, and many people, as you watched the morning news shows yesterday and other things, the apprehension seemed to stem around what was, and I think most people agree, there was going to be some sort of Iranian response here. What do you make of this response in Qatar today? We are reporting is that the Iranian government gave the Qatari government a heads up to let them know, hey, we're just targeting U.S. bases. What do you make of this response today?
Well, in certain ways, it's a relief because it does seem to be a limited attack. And it certainly, Trump's position was basically, you know, we just bombed you. Now we want peace. You know, I mean, you can only imagine, you know, somebody going to a bar and punching somebody else and say, oh, I want peace now.
Right, it's all over now.
You don't, it's your fault, you know. But and Trump indeed said there'd be a massive retaliation. You know, we'd bomb them like they'd never seen before, far worse than they've gotten from Israel, da-da-da. And so, and one couldn't imagine, again, that Iran would not respond in some way. So here is the question. How are they going to respond? Is it going to be in a manner that you know, Trump would go ahead and do the massive bombing and things escalate, things go out of control, the Strait of Hormuz would be closed, interrupting the oil supply and the ripple effects in the global economy and all sorts of people killed. And, and you know, I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, terrible scenarios that we're considering. But it seems like the Iranian government is basically taking a middle ground. Again, they couldn't just roll over and not respond, but by doing it in such a way that they warn people ahead of time, and that the amount of missiles that came over were actually fairly small. Now, the Israelis have done a lot of damage to Iran's military capability, but they still have a lot of missiles. They could have done a swarm attack. they could have killed a fair number of Americans, not just in Qatar, but in Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Iraq. We have like 40,000 troops within just a couple hundred miles of the Iranian border, not to mention our ships in the Gulf. And, you know, so if they were really out to kill a bunch of Americans, they could have done it. And so this is, so it's a real relief, you know, that they did not go to the more maximalist response that they could have done, both in terms of the fact that there aren't, large-scale American casualties, but also it will reduce the likelihood that the United States will respond in turn and have things spiral out of control.
To help us to understand, and I, you know, I wish we had an entire afternoon to do one of your classes. I took, you know, Middle Eastern history back in high school years and years ago. I find it a fascinating region of the world. Certainly a lot of, I think most Americans would look at it as a lot of chaos. It's very complicated, hard to understand. Help break this down for those of us here in Wisconsin that might not understand this part of the world as well as you do, Professor, in terms of the Iranians have had a problem with Americans for a long, long time. Those of us old enough for us to remember the hostage situation during the 1980 presidential election between Carter and Reagan, and ever since then. And take us, if you can, Ken, a little bit from that. Give me a couple of minute background. I know it's way too short a time, but a couple of minute background, and then up to how that ties into what the Obama administration, maybe it started W. Bush, I'm not sure, but the Obama administration, Trump 1, Biden, now Trump 2, about trying to have inspectors in Iran. There were negotiations going on, and the difference between that and the enrichment for Iranians to make a bomb and why that's important. We can come back and spend more time on it, but that's kind of the context I'd like you to help us understand, if you be so very kind.
I'd like to start a little further back, actually.
Sure, please.
In fact, way back. I mean, Iran, formerly known as Persia, has been a major regional power for like 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so they don't like being treated like some Caribbean island or Central American country where the U.S. can basically, you know, send in the Marines or whatever and make them do what they want to do. There's a lot of national pride. Now, most Iranians do not like their government, but, you know, they are very proud of their culture. Any of your listeners who know anyone of Persian background knows, you know, the pride in their heritage, in their history. And they don't like being jerked around. They don't like being told that, oh, Israel can have nuclear weapons. Pakistan have nuclear weapons. India have nuclear weapons. We can have nuclear weapons. But Iran, you can't even have a civilian program that has the potential down the road of becoming weaponized. Mm. And so that stirs up a lot of national sentiments. You don't have to be a, you know, supporter of the Ayatollah or anything like that to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this isn't really fair. And there's concern about the history of the U.S. I mean, they're back in 1953, they had a nationalist prime minister who seized the British oil companies that were exploiting the wealth of the nation without giving hardly anything in return. There are big international sanctions. And the U.S. Came in, the CIA came in and overthrew the elected prime minister. And they brought back from exile the Shah, that's basically the Persian word for emperor, who ruled as an absolute monarch, quite brutal. His Savak, the dreaded secret police that were trained by the United States, tortured and murdered many tens of thousands of people. And it was the United States that said, hey, this is a great ally here. Why don't we help them develop nuclear power? So this is an important piece to note, that it was the United States that started Iran's nuclear program. Mm. And when the Shah's regime was so effective at wiping out the leftist and nationalist and liberal and secular opposition, but they couldn't completely get into the mosques. And so when they had the revolution, it took on a strong Islamist characterization, probably a pretty reactionary Islamist characterization, which is a little unusual because the Iranians, compared to a lot of predominantly Muslim countries, have not been super religious, ultra conservative, you know, whatever. So it was a real shock to go from a more secular authoritarian regime to a religious authoritarian regime.
Right.
And they didn't have one of the first things the new regime did was they abolished the nuclear program. However, when Iraq invaded in the 1980s, used chemical weapons on a massive scale, and the world didn't respond, There are some Iranians said maybe we need to redevelop nuclear power and at least have an option of developing a nuclear weapon to protect ourselves as a deterrent. So again, this is important to emphasize that, you know, to those Iranians who did think about wanting it in, maybe get a nuclear bomb, maybe that being an option in the future, it was not to destroy Israel or the United States. It was why most countries want a nuclear deterrent. And so especially when the U.S. invaded the countries to their immediate east and west, Afghanistan and Iraq, when you saw them listed as the axis of evil along with Iraq and North Korea, and when Iraq got rid of their nuclear program and got invaded anyway, and North Korea developed nuclear weapons, they're still in power. You know, maybe there's a lesson there. Maybe you do need some kind of deterrent. But again, there's no evidence they're actually going to develop a bomb. You know, even having that potential got a lot of people concerned, given the nasty nature of the regime. Despite their anti-imperialist rhetoric, they've engaged in quite a few imperialist machinations themselves in the region. Mm-hmm. And again, I think most listeners know it is, like I say, a pretty nasty regime. But they did agree under Obama to eliminate a huge portion of their nuclear program.
Right.
It reduced its number of centrifuges to enrich uranium to a little more than 5,000, which is far below the number needed to process uranium to the 90% level needed for nuclear weapons. In fact, they agreed to, they eliminated 98% of their nuclear stockpile. They restricted the level of enrichment to 3.67 percent. They decommissioned the Iraq reactor, which could produce plutonium. They allowed inspectors to look at everything from mining and milling, conversion, enrichment, fuel manufacturing, nuclear reactors, spent fuel, everything. One of the most comprehensive inspections regimes ever, and they were abiding by it 100%. But despite that,
not to interrupt, but they had the deal was, correct me if I'm wrong, you had to have UN or inspectors were from neither country go in,
and a third party
to verify this.
No, again, right, and everybody thought, oh, this nuclear crisis, everybody's been freaking out for years, is over. You know, it took a decade of posturing, 2 years of intense negotiations. You know, I met with the Iranian foreign minister actually in 2019 when I was in Tehran, and he talked about how he had little less than 50 one-on-one meetings with John Kerry, the then U.S. Secretary of State, going over the agreement line by line by line. And then Trump comes in, and even though Iran was totally abiding by it, he threw it out and said, I negotiate a better deal. And of course he didn't. And this is not some real estate thing, you know? So Iran said, okay, if you're not going to go by the deal, we don't have to either. Because by pulling out of the deal, United States imposed these really draconian sanctions on Iran. And part of it was that they would punish any government or a company that didn't go with the sanctions as well. So that meant a lot of other countries and everything. So it ended up really hurting the economy. And the Iranians destroyed billions of dollars worth of equipment in return for lifting the sanctions. And the U.S., you know, said, too bad, you know, it's over. And so, and here's the thing. I can't emphasize this enough.
You know what? I'm going to stop. This is called a tease, Professor, because we're up against the clock. So if you want to know the key thing that Professor Zunes is going to tell us, stick around for 2 minutes. You'll find it out on the other side. Professor Stephen Zunes of University of San Francisco helping us break down this breaking news as Iran has attempted to attack U.S. military bases in Qatar. It's the Todd Allball Show for a Monday. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Cross Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network across the state of Wisconsin. Glad to have you along on a Monday, June 23rd, 22 minutes now past the hour of 2 o'clock as we continue to follow breaking news at this hour. Iran said that it has launched an attack on the U.S. Air Force, of the U.S. base, rather, Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, just 2 days after the U.S. Struck three nuclear sites there. So far, no word of any U.S. casualties. It seems that so far, reports are that interceptor type of missiles have stopped those ballistic short and mid-range reported missiles from actually landing on the U.S. airbase here. Here to help us sort through all of this, we appreciate it so very much, joining us live via StreamYard from San Francisco, Stephen Zunes, the professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Professor, again, thank you so very much. We're up against the clock. The computer cuts me off whether I want to or not, so that's why I had to stop you. And you're just about, you're giving us the history here, and this is a fantastic history of why things are the way they are to a degree. And you got to the point of saying that in recent times, now under Obama, then into Trump one term, that there was this deal of to have the Iranians basically supervised or inspected is probably a better word to make sure they weren't enriching their uranium and creating a nuclear bomb. It worked pretty well. And then Trump canceled the deal. And you said, Here's the important thing to remember. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the important thing to remember is that when you hear Trump and other Republicans, as well, for that matter, as leading Democrats, Schumer and Jeffries and Schiff and Rosen and Fetterman and others who have been supporting Israel's war on Iran, they're saying we must prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. Okay, fine. I don't want them to have a nuclear weapon either. Right. But they don't say, then let's return to the Iran nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're saying, let's go to war. So it's not an issue of whether or not someone believes Iran should develop nuclear weapon. It's that you want to do it through diplomacy, which had already been successful, or do you want to go to war with not only the horrific casualties that have been going on in both Iran and Israel, and now with the U.S. involved and the risk of something much larger. I mean, again, so this is the real issue that a lot of people, both the Republicans and the Democratic hawks, seem to be ignoring. If you really don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon, go back to the treaty that made it the agreement that made it impossible. Especially since it's unclear, despite Trump's claims, whether they actually did destroy everything.
Right.
They could easily rebuild. And even though they've killed some top scientists, they got plenty of more scientists. Right. And if anything, it's going to make Iran motivated. Maybe we do need a nuclear deterrent, so this won't happen again.
So help me explain, or help me understand this, Professor Zunes. And we got about 5 minutes here left. Just from a cultural, we hear this, quote unquote, death to America. As it's explained by some religious reasons, that the Iranians are never going to give up because they believe in this almost religious thing where Israel and the U.S. has to be wiped off the face of the map to accomplish religious goals. I guess I'll put it in those. Complete bunk, or what is that?
Yeah, that's a myth. That's a myth, and there's some deliberate mistranslations. For example, the claim that former President Ahmadinejad, who was hasn't been in power for more than 20 years, who was quoting Ayatollah Khomeini, who died way back in 1989, said that we want Israel to be wiped off the map, therefore that's Iranian policy. No, that's not Iranian policy. In fact, the phrase wiped off the map doesn't even exist in the Persian language. A more accurate translation would be vanished from the pages of time. And when Ahmadinejad was like that, he said, look at the map of the Soviet Union. Do you see it anymore? Mm-hmm. No, you see Russia and the other countries. In other words, they don't want Israel to exist as Israel. They want it to be Palestine. But that doesn't mean physically destroying Israel or killing the Jews.
And I
remember our big mistake in Vietnam was that we saw communism, and that's a totalitarian movement trying to take over the world. So we've got to respond militarily, not realizing that first and foremost, it was a nationalist movement. Mm-hmm. It was communist led, but it was a nationalist movement by people who were sticking up for their own country from foreign invaders and a puppet regime in Saigon. Similarly with Iran, we miss out on the fact that, yes, it's an Islamist republic, but first and foremost, it's nationalist and it's asserting that. And when we have these double standards, when we have these threats, when we have these things, it creates this kind of reaction. And so the more we bombed in Vietnam, the more troops we sent, the more the resistance. And similarly, the more we attack Iran, the more the resistance we're going to get from them as well.
And I apologize, we only have 2.5 minutes left, but give us your brief answer if you can. With Hamas and Hezbollah weakened, at least to a large degree, allies tangentially at least of Iran, with Iran now hit at least to some degree, having less technology, and with the lack of Arab allies in the Middle East really calling this latest strike by the U.S. out over the weekend, is there a chance at least a chance that what Trump administration did over the weekend, and could this actually lead towards a larger regional acceptance of Israel and U.S. policy, and could this actually bring some sort of peace, or is that just unknown yet?
No, I mean, it's doing just the opposite, just getting more and more resentment at the United States and Israel. Even critics of the Iranian regime, again, point out this double standard, you know, in terms of, you know, Israel itself is a nuclear power, has over 90 nuclear weapons, you know. Why? And so they really won't, Israel won't be accepted until they grant their Palestinians freedom, either in a viable two-state solution or in a binational state with equal rights for both people. I mean, and the failure for that to happen is what's led to the rise of extremist groups like Hamas, which came only after Israel ended up occupying the West Bank and Gaza, and Hezbollah, which emerged only after the Israeli, you know, occupation in 1982, parts of southern Lebanon. And similarly, I mean, ISIS emerged after the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you invade and occupy, kill a lot of civilians, that's the extremism that comes up. You don't make people moderate by bombing them and killing them, especially when you have such high civilian casualties.
Yeah. Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Amazing background, amazing knowledge. Appreciate you so very much. We'd love to have you back on again. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. We're going to have State Senator Kelda Royce next, talking about things closer to home, the Joint Finance Committee, University of Wisconsin System. Don't go anywhere. It's the Todd Allball Show for a Monday on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. 35 minutes now past the hour of 2 o'clock of this Monday, June 23rd, 2025. Zahmer is dialing up a little bluegrass there by request off of our next guest playlist here. She has been joining us, so kind to join us every Monday here through the budget process. State Senator Kelda Royce, representing the 26th District, which includes much of the city of Madison here in Dane County. She is a member of the Joint Finance Committee during this busy budget process. Well, not as busy perhaps as we'd like, but Senator, first of all, welcome. How are you?
I'm glad to be here. I wish I was doing a little more work on the budget, but...
I hear that. So first of all, bluegrass. You're in, what's that band called?
That band is called I'm With Her, and it's three women, each of whom is kind of an all-star in their own right, and they recently played here at the Overture Center in Madison, and I'm now obsessed and can't turn it off.
It's one of many things I enjoy about you. You like music and different types of music, so that's fantastic. Sad songs right now out of the state capitol, if I can be so bold, at least in the Joint Finance Committee. You were here last Monday afternoon, and on Monday night, I was able to kind of break a little bit of news about these $87 million worth of cuts that were aimed at the University of Wisconsin. Well, I still call it system. They call it University of Wisconsin now. By the Republicans on your committee, that leaked. Apparently, some people on JFC, Republicans, got a lot of calls. And they decided, boys, we better not do this. And they pulled it back. And we haven't seen hide or hair of them since.
That's right. I mean, and, you know, like, their cars aren't even at the Capitol. So I don't know what they're even doing. But, you know, I think it's good because it shows that making cuts to our essential public services is something that Republicans know they will pay a huge political price for. And so a lot of them just don't want to walk the plank. But the problem is the extremists are still driving the bus, right? And so they're in this kind of dilemma of, do they follow the extremists and try to get the votes on the Republican side? Or do they realize that that's a losing battle and actually try to save their seats, win elections, and be responsible governance?
Help me understand this a little bit, if you can. Maybe you can't, because I've been asking about the quote-unquote other side. Our friend Trigby Olson, who used to work for guys like Tommy Thompson, Scott McCallum, before he went off to D.C. and worked for John McCain and others, he knows Robin Voss pretty well. They kind of came up through college at the same time. And Trigby on Wednesday pointed out that there might not be another legislator at the building that knows or has been involved with the UW system longer. Robin Voss was actually the first student regent on UW Board of Regents. And he is a proud graduate of UW-Whitewater. Steve Noss, Senator Steve Noss, a Republican, is, you know, a graduate of UW system.
Less proud, I would
probably
presume.
Less proud, but the fact is, I guess what I want to ask your comments on, your thoughts on, is as a former Republican, I just look at it as hypocrisy. I mean, even former Governor Scott Walker, who likes to call UW system a quote-unquote woke den of indoctrination, And then he sends Trygve Olsen, our friend, Christmas cards, very proud of his son graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So my point is, these folks know the value of UW education.
They do.
They put their money into it. So is it just appeasing their base? Why are these guys, mostly guys, but I guess gals, mostly guys, just so adamant of making UW the villain?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the way they have boxed themselves in. You know, 15 years of gerrymandering has insulated them from the concerns of most Wisconsinites. It's allowed them to kind of ignore every single one of us in Wisconsin who would be proud for our kids to go to UW, any campus, and especially Madison. And when they don't have that electoral accountability, they will only respond to their base and the most extreme voices in the party. And of course, if they can try to make a wedge issue, try to divide us rather than bringing people together, it's easier for them because that's the kind of political calculus that they've set up.
Yeah. There is a story just broke about a half an hour, but was published about a half an hour ago at channel3000.com, the CBS affiliate. Headline here in Madison says, UW-Madison tells schools and colleges to trim budgets amid federal and state funding uncertainty. Read your first couple of lines. Dean and vice chancellors at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which senator you represent, will have to make tough choices in the coming weeks, university leadership said today. The budget cuts about the next fiscal year, rather. Schools and colleges will be required to cut their base budget by 5% of their fiscal year 2026 fund 101 allocations. You can explain what all that means. All other parts of the universities that receive fund 101 monies, including administrative, will have their base budget cuts by 7% in fiscal year 26 allocation. To the layperson, Senator, explain what all that means. And is this predicated on not having a new budget? Or what is Chancellor Mnuchin really looking at here?
Well, I would say this is basically the university being responsible and trying to figure out what are some worst case scenarios here. They're not just facing the prospect of not having a state budget, but they're also facing potential significant cuts in the federal government, cuts to student aid that really affect the most vulnerable students, the kids who probably have the most to gain from college, changes in international students. You know, for the University of Wisconsin-Madison in particular, we're a destination for the best and brightest all over the world. That is maybe not going to continue to be the case under the Republican administration in Washington. So they're looking at all these things and saying, well, we're going to have to make some very, very difficult choices. It means that student services are going to be cut, classes are going to be cut, majors are going to be cut, and potentially campus-wide, if you want to look at systems as a whole, we're talking about additional closures of campuses, right? Yeah. So if you're just extrapolating. So I think, you know, the state budget is one component of it, but just more broadly, I think there's a lot of challenges in higher ed right now. And to me, it's infuriating because I and people in my generation and older than me have benefited tremendously from access to higher education and great public education. And, you know, it is outrageous that we are pulling the ladder up behind us and taking those opportunities away from young people and kids today.
We're speaking with State Senator Kelda Royce of the 26th District of Wisconsin here in Dane County. She is also a member of the Joint Committee on Finance, better known as JFC. Senator, before we move off of the university's part, I would be remiss. We haven't talked about it on this show in a long, long time, but I want to get your take on this. I'm a little long in the tooth, a little gray in the beard. I've been around long enough to having worked for my former boss, Dale Schultz, Senate Majority Leader on the Republican side. I was in the building, as they say, when the University of Wisconsin system had a huge surplus in their rainy day fund. And Republicans who like to say we have to be conservative with taxpayer dollars, we can't overspend, they actually voted on something called Joker and they made the university get rid of all of their right. resources. Explain this a little bit and why that is so important today.
Well, and we've seen it wasn't just then, right? The Republicans have done this a couple of times where the university knows that the state is not a reliable funding partner and has not been for a long time. I mean, certainly under Walker, but even before that, right? State support has really shrunk dramatically. It's maybe a third of what it was as a percentage of UW's budget compared to when I was born. So trying to, you know, manage that and be responsible, they were want to have a buffer. They don't want to be completely dependent and have to immediately fire professors and turn students away if the state decides to reduce money. But then Republicans say, oh, they've got a surplus. They don't need money. So we're going to slash it, or we're going to take that money and force them to spend it down just to keep the doors open. Well, you can't have it both ways, right?
Right.
I mean, either you want public agencies to be responsible with their money, and that means saving and having some money for a rainy day, just like the state has money in a rainy day under the current governor, several budgets in a row. But you can't use that then as a cudgel and say, well, then we're not going to fund you.
Yeah. Now, I just think the hypocrisy, again, of my former party to want, quote unquote, fiscal conservatism, which I'm fine with, but then to penalize the UW for being, right. for being fiscally conservative.
Right. Exactly. Because it just shows that they're not. I mean, right. you know, here's this so-called accountant caucus. We've had an accountant as head of our finance committee for the last several budgets. And what has he done but, you know, bring his school districts, the municipalities that he represents, to the brink of bankruptcy?
Mm-hmm. No, Senator's talking about Howard Markline, the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee. Used to be live in his district. He likes being called Howie, I guess.
Oh, I don't know. He never asked me to call him that.
I don't. I know somebody went to school with him. He doesn't like that at all. That's why I keep saying it. Very quickly, not quickly really, but we have before the first break, and I want to come back and talk about other things in the Capitol. Let's talk a little bit in terms of Joint Finance Committee. Are we really headed here, Senator Royce, towards no budget at all? And just keeping the same spending? And if so, what does that mean for some of the key issues that you're concerned about?
Well, we are so far behind on the state budget. I mean, it's by statute, it has to be done June 30th. And there are a bunch of kind of time sensitive things that we need to get done by then in order to get federal money, right? So this could be catastrophic for all kinds of departments and state agencies if we don't get the budget done on time. More broadly, it means that our school districts and our local governments are not going to know how much money they're going to have to spend. And if we go back to what they were getting in 2023, obviously we've had big inflation since then, yeah. right? And it's not going to cover their current costs. So this could be really disastrous for all the public services that we rely on.
We've talked about it on this program. I know our friends Jane Mattner, Greg Bach, and Mattner on Air from 9 until 11 have talked about it as well, other programs. But what I'm really – I don't see one side, namely Republicans, talking about this. If there is no budget for whatever reason, if this, mm-hmm. if the spending holds where it is, that is still a huge loss for our child care providers in this state.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And explain why that is. In terms of the lack of federal funding?
Sure. So for the last 20 years, we've lost over half of the providers in the state, right? We've got a situation where in the majority of the state, there are three kids who need care for every one child care slot. And the main reason is because it's very expensive to provide care for young kids. You can't outsource it. You can't have AI do it. There's no chatbot that will change a toddler's diaper and take him out to play in the snow. But And the amount that it costs is outpacing what families can afford. For so many people, it's more than the cost of their mortgage or their rent. It actually is more than the cost of college to send a baby to childcare, to a good, high-quality early childhood care center. And so families can't afford it, and yet the workers are making poverty wages just because the economics don't match. This is a situation where there's a market failure and there needs to be public investment. So in the pandemic, when you saw just the bottom fallout of the child care industry, and everybody also realized, hey, this is essential. We literally cannot work without child care. And anybody who was on Zoom at that time knows why right. you can't work without child care. And so the governor took money that was from the federal government, and most states did this, part of the ARPA plan, and put money into a program called Child Care Counts, which gave money directly to providers to bridge that gap between the cost of providing that care and paying a living wage to their provider so they were able to stay in the classroom and stay in the industry, and what parents can afford to pay. And that's what we should be doing.
So just make sure that I understand this as, in layman's terms, that we use federal funds during the Biden
Correct.
Administration and Governor Evers put that in place to kind of put a Band-Aid over what was already a problem
Absolutely.
With healthcare.
Now yes.
Now the Trump administration is seemingly ready to cut those funds off. If
right.
there's
They're
no-
running out. I mean, those funds are gone now, right?
Right.
So they are running out in a few weeks. And the last of them, I think, will be September 30th. So if right. we don't put new public investment in from the state level, That's it. There's no cavalry coming to save us.
So even if your Republican colleagues are going home to their districts and say, well, we'll be fine, because even if we'll just keep operating like we were, even if there's no state budget, that is a major cut to child care providers, correct?
It sure is. And they better talk to some parents and providers in their district.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to come back, talk more with State Senator Kelda Royce here on a Monday edition of the Todd Allball Show. Don't go anywhere. Senate Republicans are okay with them holding or having guns on the session floor, but not other people. We'll discuss after this. Don't go anywhere on Civic Media. Ready to know.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. 8 minutes now before the hour of 3 o'clock, coming up at the top of the hour. News from ABC and CBS, of course, updating us on the latest attacks on U.S. Bases in Qatar. The last couple of hours or so, we'll maintain our vigilance on bringing you the latest on that. Also, weather and looks like maybe a few storms in parts of Wisconsin later this afternoon and into tonight. Some may be severe, so be aware of that. And then a great sports reporter, Mike Clemens, followed by what's worse, an hour two, we'll give Senator Royce a little heads up. We'll let her answer first. Our guest this half hour is State Senator Kelda Royce, Democrat of the 26th District, also a member of the Joint Finance Committee. Senator, quickly, what's worse, heat wave or cold snap?
Ooh, I'm going to say heat wave.
Really?
Yeah.
Why so?
Well, because, I don't know, you can always start a fire and warm up and drink some cocoa. And it's not bad to be in bed covered in a slanket.
True. I guess I think I have to be outside. Maybe I've just become soft. But it seemed like we haven't had one in a while. But like those Arctic, whatever they call them, things where they last for 2 weeks and going in and out of, I don't know.
No, I don't. I mean, I'm not saying I like it. I prefer just temperate weather, like Hawaii all the time. Why not? But if you're making me choose.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair. All right, fair. On to more serious issues. Over the weekend, another great program up front from WISN in Milwaukee. They interviewed Senator, one of your colleagues on the Republican side of the aisles, Chris Kapinga. And I heard Jane Mattner talk about this before. I've been mispronouncing his name. Dan Schaefer had it right. Of course, he is our political editor.
Of course he does.
Editor,
I mean, he knows everything about the Capitol. He probably knows what I had for breakfast before I even...
Senator Kapinga was on up front over the weekend, and they asked him about security. You and I, Senator, talked about this last week in light of the tragedy, the assassination in the Minnesota legislature a couple of weeks ago. And they asked him in terms of security. And well, here's the cut from up front over the weekend.
Do you want metal detectors at the front entrances? What is
in? Yeah, I have not been through another Capitol that has not had a metal detectors. And it's going beyond that at this point. There are systems out there, and we learned this when we researched them, that will actually detect any type of weapon or dangerous object. So it's far beyond metal detectors, but it's gone now because we need to have a higher level of security just because of, unfortunately, ingenuity out there with how you can hurt people.
Do you also want guns prohibited from inside the Capitol or on the floor?
Yes. What Indiana, for instance, it's a great example that I bring up a lot, is that Indiana is extremely conservative and pro personal protection. So what they allow is they allow legislators to carry into the building for protection, which I always do. I always have been armed to protect myself, especially when I'm up in the front in the president's spot. That was, I just felt it was very important. But the general public, they don't need to have their weapons in the people's house. In the people's house, it's their representatives who are elected. That's the voice of the people. And I need to be protected as a public servant, and so does everybody else who's been elected into that spot. We should not be worrying about our lives walking into that building.
So you still want lawmakers to be able to carry inside and on the floor?
Absolutely.
State Senator Republican Chris Kapinga on the program up front, WISN, over the weekend. Senator Royce, reaction?
Well, I agree that we shouldn't have to risk our lives, but I believe everyone deserves to be safe in the Capitol, and the presence of guns by anyone makes us less safe. And that's not just true in the Capitol. It's true at the grocery store, church, schools, right? Concerts. The idea that of everybody just armed to the teeth just means that you could end up with a tragedy or an accident that turns deadly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Wisconsin legislature, actually, I believe that there was, years ago, one legislator shot another legislator. Of course, that was the Assembly, not the Senate.
Well, of course.
But, it doesn't make me feel great to think about my colleagues carrying a gun, and maybe they just decide one day they've had enough of what I have to say. And, you know, nobody should feel silenced or threatened or intimidated by a gun. And, you know, we had a member of the assembly who was the Speaker pro tem, Bill Cramer, who always kind of gave me a little bit of a weird feeling. And he made it known when that he was packing heat and he was standing up at the front of that room. And he ended up later being unfortunately convicted of sexual assault. I mean, fortunately convicted, right, but unfortunately he committed sexual assault. And, you know, I just think nobody should get a special exemption there.
Well, and my feeling is nobody should be packing heat at the Capitol except for the Capitol Police.
Right,
And to me, again, it's the hypocrisy of Kapinga saying he can sit on the floor and have a handgun, but other people can't, like the general public can't. Right. I mean, it's either got to be one way or the other. And again, for my former party likes to say back the blue, to me it says they don't have any confidence in the Capitol Police
absolutely.
To keep them safe.
And who opposed the expansion of concealed carry? It was obviously law enforcement. You know, my dad was a police officer. He was a state trooper briefly and spent his career in law enforcement. And he always said, you know, it's so much more dangerous for law enforcement the more people have guns and the more places they take them.
I don't want to see fourth graders lining up for 2 hours going through a
Me
metal
neither.
Detector.
And, you know, there's something really beautiful about having this building that belongs to all of us be open. I want it to still be open. Yeah. I don't want anyone to be able to bring a gun, but I want it to be open.
Minute left. My former party, the Republicans, seem to be in a little bit of chaos.
Yes, it's a little bit of disarray. I mean, they've got obviously what's happening federally with this right-wing revolt against the right-wing presidency and calls for the state party chair to step down even after he was just reinstalled. And then, of course, here at the state level, we've got a legislature where, you know, one party can't or one house can't count to get a majority of votes to pass a budget and the other one's, you know, trying to negotiate directly with the governor. So who knows?
Yeah. If you want to get a hold of Brian Schimming, Edgewater Pier, he'll be having a Diet Coke.
Oh, yeah. That sounds great.
A little hitherto unknown fact. At least that's what he used to do 15 years ago. I'm not sure if he's still there or not.
Well, it's not a bad way to spend the day, even soupy heat wave day like today.
You can always find State Senator Kelda Royce on the job at the Capitol. You can find her here on Mondays for the budget process. Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. Stay tuned. What's worse is next. Do you agree with Senator Royce that a heat wave is worse? Or is it a cold snap? And we'll talk with Matt DeFore on AI in media. Is Todd going to be replaced? We'll find out next hour on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The answer is yes.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.